And I think that our role and responsibility as clinicians and also as leaders, because I really do believe that this should be a core skill of any leader in the healthcare system, is to be intentionally anti-racist.
Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the podcast from the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram. I'm the Vice President of MWF, and I have the honour and joy of being your host, as each week we hear from wonderful guests to help you feel more empowered and confident on your medical career journey. Hello, everyone. I hope that you are all well. Spring is definitely on the way. I've been very excited by going out and seeing the first few snowdrops and other flowers. So hopefully the weather will start getting warmer. I don't know about you, but I like having longer days and more sunshine. So last week we had the second of our MWF RSM evenings, and it was all about looking at inequalities, past, present and future. It was really nice to meet some of you virtually and in person. And I hope that those who joined found the event really, really helpful and inspiring. I have to say, I really enjoyed the event. It was my first time speaking at a national event and my first time chairing, and also doing like live podcast interviews, which were different because whenever we record virtually, I can always say, you know, or if you make a mistake or if there's any bit that you think, oh, I actually want to restart that's fine. Our wonderful editor, Jenna, can edit that out. But you can't do that on a live podcast. So that was a really interesting experience for me. And I hope it was enjoyable and helpful for those who joined. Just a quick shout out as well that it's now less than 4 weeks to our MWF Spring Conference. And for various reasons, we've decided to have it completely virtually. So it'll be virtually on the MedAll platform on Friday, the 17th of March. There's a fabulous program. Of course, I'll say that because I'm a bit biased because I helped set up the program, but we have got some of our previous podcast guests on the program. So we'll have Susie Edwards, Dr. Nikki Ramskill, Harriet Whaley-Cohen, Professor Partha Kaur, amongst lots of wonderful panelists and speakers. So please, please do try and get study leave to join on Friday, the 17th of March. And if you can't make it live, you will have access to a recording as well. We're trying to make it as accessible to everybody as possible. So for medical students, it'll be cheaper to become a member because it's £5 for membership, and then you get free attendance at the conference. So I'll pop a link in the show notes to all of that and hope to see you all there virtually. Now, at last week's RSM MWF event, we had a discussion about inequalities, including race. And the data shows that if you are a non-white doctor, it affects, you know, your skin color affects your progression at ARCP, your success rate at exams, the likelihood of getting a consultant post. And we spoke about different privileges that we all have. So for me, I am a woman and a woman of color, but I have a British accent. And I know that gives me privilege compared to my colleagues who might look like me but don't have a British accent. So it's really important that we all think about the privileges that we have and then do something to support those who don't have those privileges. And this week's episode is all about the importance of language, particularly when it pertains to race. So this week's guest is Miss Evelyn Mensah, who is a consultant ophthalmology surgeon. She also leads and directs various different groups that she mentions. In this conversation, we discussed calling things out, but also calling things in, which was something that I hadn't come across before. So I think you'll find that really interesting and very helpful. And, you know, I've said multiple times on this podcast, because it's something that I definitely believe, lots of the problems that we have are systems problems. But I think as individuals, we do have the power to change those systems rather than feeling, oh, well, it's a system problem, so I can't do anything about it. And Evie in this episode gave a great example of one of her trainee colleagues who did make a big system change as an individual. So I think that is something that can inspire all of us. And you know, with these sorts of inequalities, we've all got a part to play to make things better for our colleagues, but also, of course, for our patients. So I think this is a very important conversation, and I'm sure that you will find it really valuable. As always, thank you so much for continuing to support the podcast and for sharing and rating and reviewing. It really helps other people to know that we exist, and it helps us to reach as many medical women as possible. So thank you for continuing to do that. Enjoy the episode. So I'm delighted today to be joined by Miss Evelyn Mensah. Welcome, Evie, to the podcast. It's lovely to have you. Could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Yes, my name's Evelyn Mensah, aka Evie. Everyone calls me Evie. Yes, I'm a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, which is an eye surgeon, and I'm based at London Northwest University Healthcare Trust, where I'm the clinical lead in the eye department based at Central Middlesex Hospital. I'm the co-lead for the Northwest London Ophthalmology CRG, and I'm also the Trust Res Expert, which means I'm the Trust Workforce Race Equality Standard Expert. So thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast.
Well, it's lovely to have you here, and I was delighted to meet Evie in person at the first RSM MWF event in November last year. And Evie brought up a really good point when somebody was speaking about microaggressions. Evie spoke up and said, you know, we need to label things as they are, and the important language that we use is really important. And I went and accosted her and said, please come and talk about this on the podcast, because it would be a great conversation.
Yeah, I remember that. Yes, the women, that session at the RSM was really very, very good. And I am careful about how I talk about my so-called microaggressions, which the reason why I'm careful about it is that I recognize that people will say things are microaggressions, and it makes it seem as if they're really small. But a lot of the time, what we're actually dealing with are episodes of racism. Microaggressions were described in a paper, and I do not remember the author, but what I will say is that that paper was in the 1970s. And whilst people may describe things as being microaggressions, what they do is they micro-invalidate you. They micromanage you as well. They kind of gaslight you to a certain degree, and it minimizes the actual impact of being the recipient of microaggressions, because the impact on the individual is certainly at a macro level, so not at a micro level. So I don't use the term microaggressions, recognizing that there are others that do. And if I feel that something is racist, I will say that it is. But I don't think people understand the word racism. So when you're talking about racism, when you're naming it and you're calling it out as such, or calling it in, when you're calling it out, you're saying that it is that. When you're calling it in, you're giving an explanation as to why that thing may be racist. People get very twitchy and touchy, and they think that it's an interpersonal thing. It may well be, but I think that a lot of time in healthcare, which is the environment in which I work, spend most of my waking day at, it's something that we need to address, and it's something that we need to call out, because that's the only way that we can tackle it. When you don't name a thing, then it never gets resolved. And I think that that our role and responsibility as clinicians, and also as leaders, because I really do believe that this should be a core skill of any leader in the healthcare system who has a position of responsibility, is to be intentionally anti-racist. Because all, as we know, multiple reports that have come out of the NHS staff survey, the Workforce Race Equality Standard publications, and the first medical workforce race equality standard publication, which looked at medical doctors and dentists, because so the RES reports, the workforce race equality standard reports, they looked at our agenda for change colleagues. So that's from band 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to very senior manager. They're non-medical, whereas the MRES looks at the medical workforce. But anyway, no matter what report you look at, year in, year out, it shows that there is a disparity where the experience of our non-white colleagues is very different from our white. And I said non-white because in the report it talks about Black minority ethnic, which I, as an aggregated term, don't particularly like, but we are where we are, and these reports have been, you know, published since 2015. So I now talk about the global majority. I don't talk about ethnic minority. I don't BAME people. It's like BAME over. No BAMing. Because, and also if I'm talking about a particular group of people, I will do it in a disaggregated fashion. So it depends on the context. So if I'm talking about an Indian population, I'll talk about an Indian population. If I'm talking about a, I don't know, if I'm talking about a Caribbean population, even though that's quite a great big group, yeah? And even African is a continent, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's a whole continent, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas, so we talk about Black, we're the Black Caribbean, Black African, all right? So we're two large, like, continent-type areas. Whereas when we talk about Asian, now when you're talking about Asian, are you talking about South Asian? Are you talking about Southeast Asian? What Asian are you talking about? But there usually are three countries tethered with that, like India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. You can disaggregate in that level, do you understand? Even on the government census, when you go onto the government website and you look at the different ethnic groups, there are about 19. It doesn't say Ghana. There's no Ghana in there, for example. And there's no Philippines. And there are lots of Philippine people working in the NHS. So yes, language does matter. And I think putting things correctly with the right terminology is very, very important. It's important because it's right. And it also helps you to engage with the audience you're actually speaking with. And also, if you're a clinician, with your patients, you know, they're individual people. So, yeah, it's very important.
Yep, absolutely. Definitely, you're right. We kind of lump big groups together when there's lots of differences between them. But I'm wondering, Evie, you know, a lot of these things are... systems, things that we need to change. But I'm also very much, you know, I keep saying on this podcast that absolutely it's systems that need to change. We're not blaming individuals, but that doesn't mean that as individuals we can't influence changing the system. So I just wonder how can we as individuals help to change this system with racism and making it more anti-racist?
Yeah, you're right in that respect. And one can never underestimate the impact of an individual person. But obviously, if you've got a group of people who are like-minded people, it is much more powerful. And I think that the way that we dismantle systemic racism is by calling it out, identifying situations. For example, this morning, I was giving a lecture to the ophthalmology specialist trainees in West London. And the title of my talk was Medical Retina Inequality and Inequity. Now, interesting, I'm not going to bore everybody with my subspecialist area, which is medical retina. But what was very interesting was that one of the trainees at the end, when they were asking questions, and this trainee was white and male, told me that there is a brochure for low visual aids, and the brochure, which he said was pointed out to him by his wife, who I assume is white too, had white people on the front. So it looks as if the low visual aids, which are like magnifying glasses and things like that, it's a document, and it was actually just published. I think he either said 2021 or 2022. So we're not talking 1970s or 1980s. We're talking
Yeah.
in the last couple of years. There's a brochure that's been published on the use of low visual aids, and it's just got white people on the picture at the front. Now let's think about this. When we're talking about blindness in this country, or eye conditions where you've got some sort of visual disability, the commonest causes, I would say, are age-related macular degeneration. Okay, that does impact white people more than maybe black and South Asians, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't impact them. It does. Diabetic retinopathy, which is definitely much more prevalent in our global majority populations, and glaucoma, again, that's more prevalent. So the people who will be, and especially in London, if you think about it, and also all the inner cities in the country, like Birmingham and Manchester and places like that, because the country is very multi-ethnic, isn't it? Yeah. So if you see this brochure and it's only just got white people on the front, then it's almost like the services are not there for you. They're not designed for you. What message does that bring? But already that trainee is actually writing, I think he said to the RNIB or the college, he's going to write to them and point this out to them. That is dismantling systemic racism. All right. They may not feel that it's racist, but it is to have a brochure that's just got white people in. Because when we look at our NHS anyway, as it stands on average, has a global majority population of workforce of 22%. And if you're just looking at London, it's as high as 44% or even higher. Yeah. And if you're talking about where I work at London Northwest, we're going on to 70% in my trust of 9,000 people. And also the population that we serve has that same level of diversity, where the global majority population is almost 70%. That's the population that we serve. So can you imagine if we're just giving out these leaflets, which has got all you just like one, skin color on it? Yeah. So I think that was just a very, very sort of like recent example that happened today. So that's how you dismantle systemic racism as a individual. But then also, interestingly, this week I was on a podcast with the Cambridge, the Black Students Medical Society, and we were talking about calling in, calling out racism, because it can be quite difficult, especially if you're a junior doctor and you're the recipient, or if you're receiving it from a patient on a ward, and that can be really very, very challenging and quite difficult too. Yeah.
And what sort of things would you say we can do when we are in that situation?
Well, there's a very good website, and I'm happy to share the link. And I don't know whether you can put that,
Yeah, we can put it in the show
put it.
notes.
Oh yeah, okay. So there are some terms and terminologies that you can use when you want to actually call out somebody who is, like, for example, just say, for example, you're on the ward, and a patient says something to you like, oh, I don't want you to. I w oh, ask to. They said something to you like, "Where are you from?" That old chestnut. You know how I don't know how you identify as, but I identify as a Geordie Ghanaian.
Geordie Ghanaian, that's brilliant. I always find that question really difficult to answer because it seems like such a simple question. But I always pause and think, well, do you mean
why are they asking?
From in the UK, or do you mean like where am I from originally? And are you asking me this question because I have brown skin? It's always like there's just a big pause and all this thought, and you know, and I could see them kind of looking at me like I asked you a simple question, but for me it's quite complicated to answer it.
So people, if people ask, right, so the reason why I say that I'm a Geordie Ghanaian is because I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne at the RVI. Yeah. And so I was born and bred in Newcastle upon Tyne, but my parents immigrated from Ghana in West Africa. And I'd identify, so even though I was not born in Ghana, I was brought up by Ghanaian parents, eating Ghanaian food, listening to them speaking Shri. I don't speak it myself. My parents didn't teach me our language because they were worried that we would be discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they spoke to us in English, which is, I'm sad about that, actually. So I can actually understand Shri, but I cannot speak it. And I think that's really, really sad. But they were so scared, and because they were facing their own level of discrimination in the northeast of England. It's pretty, pretty tough, the northeast of England, all right, you know, in those days. So they did not want to confuse me. And I think that the other thing that they said, it was interesting, was because in the flat that my parents were in, the family downstairs were French. And the mother was speaking French to her child, and the child was getting really, really confused. So they had that caveat too. So because I identify, so I, if I tick the if I was to tick a box where I had to declare what my ethnicity was, it would be Black, British, African.
Mm.
Yes. So I recognize that I'm British because I was born here. But I've never lived in Ghana, but I do identify as an African from Ghana. Mm-hmm. So that's why I call myself a Geordie Ghanaian. So it's those two. How do you identify? So if somebody asks me where I'm from, I'll say, oh, I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne. My parents came over from Ghana in the 60s. Why are you asking?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to just bring that curiosity of, oh, why are you asking? Because sometimes it is just curiosity that they're asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do I answer that question? I think I say that my family's originally from South India, and I'm a Yorkshire lass that's lived all over England.
Were you born in Yorkshire?
So I actually lived in India until I was 5, and then spent a bit of time in Scotland and then England. So I kind of identify all over the place.
Exactly, it's really difficult, and you don't know, you know, you don't know what I mean. One of my friends the other day, who's South Asian, I don't want to give too much away. She was telling me that her daughter was asked where she was from, and she said Queen's Park. That's where she's from. And she was like, no, but where are you from? And she was like, London.
Yeah, it is. It can be really confusing.
And she wasn't trying to be difficult at all. I promise you, she really was not trying to be difficult, but she just did not know what it was that they were trying to actually get at. So it can be really quite difficult.
Yeah. And I remember being a medical student on placement, and I was based in Hereford, which is, you know, not that diverse a place. And I remember one of the patients saying, oh, so do you think you'll go back to your own country when you qualify? And I sort of like said, I don't know what you mean, because this has been my country since I was a child.
Exactly. So this is the thing. So this is what we've got to be very careful about, you know, because I know some people probably will disagree. But I think that, you know, I wouldn't mind if everybody got that same level of interrogation. Mm. I think there's a difference between asking for curiosity, and there's a difference between interrogating and trying to understand. And also people have to just get with the program and just recognize that, you know, The UK is multicultural. It is. There are lots of different ethnicities. Actually, you know what? In Brent, where the borough that I cover, you know, there are 150 different languages spoken there. Can you imagine?
My God.
150. I tell you what, language line is my friend in the clinic. You know, the telephone service where you can call up and get the online interpreter. So many different languages. There was one language, though, that we did not get on the language line, which is Konkani.
Oh, okay. Yes, it's quite a rare Indian language.
Yeah, but it's fascinating because I've had two patients that can speak Konkani. So I think they better get that one on the list, don't you think?
Yes.
So they better. But you were asking me about calling out and calling in, weren't
Yes,
you?
yep.
Yeah. So basically, calling out is basically when you're calling out somebody when it pertains to racism, what it is, it's and this is actually from the diversity tufts.edu resources, and I will send you the link, all right?
Great, and we'll put that
So
in the
people
show
can, yeah,
notes.
exactly. So basically, it's an opportunity for people when you're actually calling out somebody. It's when you actually need to tell somebody that their words or their actions are actually unacceptable and they will not be tolerated. And sometimes you have to really do that, you know. In order to sort of like interrupt what's happening, just to prevent any further harm in yourself. Because, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with racism on a daily basis or even at all, it has a significant negative impact on your well-being. You don't feel good, you don't feel right, and you feel really, really uncomfortable. So it's a good opportunity when you're calling out just to sort of like hit that sort of like pause button. And the sort of things that people can say are sometimes you can just say to them, "Can I just stop you right there?" All right? You know, words like that. Can I just stop you right there and just say, the words that you're using are actually, I'm finding them really quite offensive. I'm finding them quite triggering. I think you need to be a bit more mindful. Maybe you should use, you know, a different word. I don't know whether you've considered the impact of your words. Actually, you know what? It sounds like you're making quite a lot of assumptions that we actually need to unpack a bit. I don't actually find that funny. Can you tell me why that was funny to you? You know, so on the website, it's got this table and it's got all the different phrases that you can use when you're actually calling somebody out. And when you're calling somebody in, and I also say you don't have to call people in if you don't want to. Some people will say, oh, it might be kinder to call somebody in, but sometimes you can't be bothered because actually the person's actually been quite revolting and you don't want to do it. But what it is, it's an opportunity to actually explore deeper the meaning of what it is that they've actually said, where you're actually seeking to understand and learn more. It's almost like a gentle, it's not quite calling it, it's like a gentle and sort of like questioning and curiosity about what someone has actually said. And when you're actually calling in someone, the sort of phrases that you can use when you're trying to call in somebody is you can say things, you know what, I'm really curious. What was your intention when you actually, you know, said that thing? Or, you know what, someone else might actually see this differently. Is it possible that someone might have misinterpreted the words and the actions that you've done? And how did you actually decide and determine? How did you actually come to that conclusion, can I ask? And actually, why do you actually think that that's true? So you see the difference. So it's not like saying, oh, you've done this and you know, like that. It's like it gets them to explain and reflect a bit on their behavior and their actions. And you can actually even get them to think of solutions. Like, in your opinion, what do you think is the best case scenario? Or how do you feel is the best way to conclude or make a conclusion or determine what the meaning of that is. You understand? So that's the difference, I think, between the two. Yeah. So I think that's a really good website. What I would really, really, really love is for there to be a website for the NHS. Anybody in the NHS, whether you're even a medical student or a trainee or a doctor that's working, or not just doctors, the whole workforce, the whole workforce, because racism in the NHS does not affect just clinicians, it affects nurses, it affects admin, everybody, even the cleaner probably, right? Even the cleaners, yes. Yeah, every aspect. And it's a website where people can, if something's happened to them, they can go to this website. It's a bit like that everyone's invited website, you know, when they were looking at situations of sexism, misogyny, and they were asking people to post their the things that had happened to them. But what would be really good is that if people post a scenario and they're all subcategorized into different things, and then people then have solutions of how to address it. So then, for example, if you're a user, you would come onto this platform. I don't know who would host it. It'd have to be NHS England. Whether they would do it or not, I have no clue. I don't know. It'd be great if they could, since it's happening in the NHS. All right.
Yeah, hopefully NHS England are listening to this.
Yes, NHS England. Can we have a website, please? Yeah, so it's hosted. People put in what's happened to them, right? Or a scenario. It could be very simple. It could be something as simple as, I'm a junior doctor, and my consultant has made a comment about the brightness of my outfit, and just say that the print happens to be African print, right? I don't think there's anything, I love African print, I really do. And they've not only made a comment about the brightness of my outfit, they've also made a comment about the braids in my hair, the way that my hair is styled. Mm. Yeah. How do I proceed? So it's basically asking a junior person to address a situation with a senior, somebody who could impact their career in terms of their progression, all right, and whom they may feel frightened of or scared of, but know that if they wanted to be their authentic self, they would actually want to call it out. And maybe people could have some suggestions of how they could actually address that. Personally, let me tell you something. I feel that every single leader, anyone who is anything, whether a clinical lead, whether a clinical director, whether they are the chief medical officer, chief nursing officer, chief everything, everybody should do a bit of anti-racism reading, personally. Mm-hmm. That's what I think, 100%. So I had a meeting with with the Trust executive group, and I basically said to them, look, and actually the CEO is actually reading a fantastic book, actually, and I'm really looking forward to conversations that I will have with our CEO. But I think that a key or a core skill of every leader in the NHS should be anti-racism, and they need to move out of their comfort zone, go into their growing edge, lean into their area of discomfort, and do some reading and educating and talking with a few people. And I think we'd have less problems in the NHS if they educated themselves in that respect. Because what usually happens, Ithana, is that people will say, oh, maybe we can send that person on to some, I tell you what, why don't we do a bit of reverse mentoring? Why don't we send that person on a management course? Why don't we send them on this course, telling them how to present? You know, why don't we just, you know, and I'm saying, you know what? Those things are actually fantastic. You know, those self-educational things, But what about the work that you need to do? What about the work that you need to do that stops you from discriminating against the person who's got a Nigerian or a Jamaican accent? Because you might think that that is unprofessional compared to somebody who's got an Italian, Spanish, or French. You see the difference. And that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, when we have, like, whenever we've got a job description, there's always essential and desirable criteria.
Yes.
It's like that needs to be on the essential criteria for anyone, not just people in leadership, because
no, everyone. Yes, absolutely everyone. I mean, they probably do have, but the thing is, let me tell you something, Nathana, what they will have is they'll have something that says EDI.
Mm.
So what's EDI? Equality, diversity, and inclusion. So that encompasses what? All 9 protected characteristics. So all your 9 protected characteristics pertain to gender, LGBTQ+, disability, etc. But the protected characteristic where the NHS workforce feels that they're discriminated for the most is on the basis of their ethnicity. So if you look at the NHS staff survey, you'll see that from 2015 to 2022, ethnicity, i.e. racism, is going in an upward trajectory, up to 48%. Almost 50% of the people that respond on the NHS staff survey on the basis of how do you feel you are discriminated, it's on the basis of their ethnicity. And then when you look at that graph, down the bottom is disability, LGBTQ+, gender, do you understand?
Yeah.
So what people will do is that they will do EDI things pertaining, that's easy.
You end up spreading yourself thinly over all the protected characteristics, don't you?
Yes, you do. And then the one that's the most difficult to tackle, which is racism, just sort of like gets kicked into the long grass.
Yeah, people don't want because
to,
it's difficult.
They don't want to, it's difficult.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much, Evie. You've given us so many like helpful tips there for how we can call things in and call things out. So we'll definitely put a link in the show notes. I've just got some quick fire questions for you, if that's okay.
That's fine.
So my first question is there any book or several books that you would recommend to our listeners? And they can be about anything.
Yes, I will. My number one book is The Anti-Racist Organization by Shireen Daniels. And I had the pleasure of meeting the author. In fact, I did a little video of it on Instagram. You'll see on Instagram. I'm always on social media. Yeah, she's a fantastic writer. So The Anti-Racist Organization, number one. Number two, The Good Ally by Nova Reid. And number three is How to Be an Anti-Racist by Professor Ibram Kendi. Those are my top three.
Thank you. They're all amazing. And I've not read them yet. So looking forward to reading those. My next question is there anything you know now that you wish you had known earlier on in your career?
No, I don't think so. I would have liked to have known that my too no-ness, my parents said to me that I was too no. That is a colloquial way of saying that I'm a know-it-all, but I'm not. So when I was younger, my parents would say to me, oh, you think you know everything, you're too no, you're too... But what I realized that what that was, it's not a negative thing, it's a positive thing. And I've used that, and I did not realize that I would be using that to advocate for others. Because even though I identify as Black, African, British, and even though I may experience racism myself in the NHS, which I do, I hate injustice, I cannot bear it. So I will definitely call out and I will advocate for others. So basically my so-called two-no-ness is me advocating for others. So I don't really care, actually. I'm fine with it. I live with that.
Well, I think that's brilliant. And my last quickfire question is a question that I'm borrowing from a group of children and young people that work with the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. So they came up with this question when they were interviewing people for the role of president. And I thought it was brilliant. So they very kindly let us borrow it. So the question is, if you were a type of biscuit, what type of biscuit would you be and why?
If I was a type of biscuit, if I was a type of biscuit, I think I would be a custard cream. And the reason why I'd be a custard cream is that I think that sometimes people think I'm harder than I am, and I'm not. And I've got, and I'm soft in the middle. I'm a complete softie. I really am. And I think people think when they, and sometimes I've heard people say that they are a little bit scared of me. I am not scary. I crack a lot of jokes. The fact that people may not get my jokes is another matter. But I will say that my door is always open. I am not scary. Maybe I'm making myself seem worse than I am, but I'm not. Yes, I might seem a little bit, I think I put up my guard and I will seem tough in certain situations, but I am very, very soft, very empathetic as well. So I'd be a custard cream.
Oh, well, I think that's a lovely answer. Thank you so much, Evie. It's been so lovely speaking to you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women Podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you, and all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.